I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at Geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Lowe's knows to bring your vision to life, it's important to find the right color. That's why Mylowe's Rewards members get a free Valspar paint or exterior stain sample to test your look to confidently refresh your space. Offer valid in-store only 87 to 820. Limit one per customer while supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See associate for details. Rewards program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Welcome to the first episode of D&D Shelf Life, the fireside chat with two DMs without the fireside. Thank you for being here, Chris. Let's start off, if you could introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your Dungeon Master resume.
Sure. My name's Chris Anderson. I have been playing Dungeons & Dragons in general on and off for about 30 years at this point. Starting off in middle school, I've played second edition pretty much my entire life. I never felt the need to change. A big part of that was that I played as a player in a game with the same group of people for roughly 20 years, one continuous storyline.
Wow.
And it is from that game that I've basically based my career as a dungeon master, or how I dungeon mastered. My dungeon master, Hal Johnson, taught me everything I know about dungeon mastering. If you're looking for another dungeon master to talk to, I strongly recommend I will put you in touch with Hal. He was a comparative religions major in college. And one thing that he did that I did that inspired by him was to base his game world in just historical Earth. But everywhere you go, the mythology of that region is true. But to also interweave, you know, like you would have halflings living in Ireland, and you'd have dwarves up in Scandinavia, you know, just taking different regional areas, folk tales about little folk, and making that into your demi-humans. And he just did an incredible job of taking an existing world and world building from it. And that's one thing. So what I did as a dungeon master was I would do that a lot with the worlds that I would try to build, because I found it a very effective shortcut. Do you know what I mean? It does half of the heavy lifting for you, because the main people that I dungeon master for is newbies. Over the course of my dungeon mastering career, I've had games for, I want to say, at least 40 people who have never played Dungeons & Dragons before. And basically it's because as the sort of Dungeons & Dragons revival rolled out, more and more people were interested. And so I just keep on meeting new, like, groups of three people who'd be like, oh, you do Dungeons & Dragons? I'm like, yeah, I can teach you guys how to play, definitely, for sure. And so I always enjoy that process. It's a situation where I get to feel very knowledgeable about something when meeting new people, which is a very comfortable way of meeting new people when you have social anxiety. And I think setting it in a real world when you're dealing with new players really helps do a lot of the heavy lifting for you in terms of world building. And, you know, I also am a big advocate of setting yourself up for success in terms of workload with this sort of thing.
Work like smarter, not harder.
Yeah. I could spend, you know, a month drawing like a continent and thinking of the different cities' economies or whatever, or I can go to Wikipedia and say, oh, what was going on in Constantinople in around 800?
Boom. Oh no, you I'm being subtweeted on the first episode of my own show.
it's just, it's so much better that it's a smart play.
I hear you. I mean, I pull from history in my own way, but yeah, I love sitting down and just kind of like, I'll do the Rorschach thing where it's like, I'll just pick a random image and kind of like draw shapes out of it. And that's my world map. then I think about how much geography affects, you know, how civilizations develop from agrarian societies and things like that. And I do all of that nonsense of like creating 800 years of history that none of my players have ever cared about.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially with new players, it's so difficult to get them to grasp the idea of a story hook. They can sometimes be so resistant. So sort of the more open you can be and like free, be like, oh, you want to go to the next town? Okay. There is a next town. You know, you want to, you know, all those little things that, new players do. And I love all the quirks of new players. It's one of the reasons why I love playing with them.
And I think that everyone has some part of themselves that wants to try Dungeons and Dragons, which is part of the reason why I love it. And I know for years, I only started playing about 9 years ago.
Okay.
But I'd wanted to play for much longer. And I think one of the things that stopped me was the inability to get a group of people together and feeling like I needed to be surrounded by either people who, just like me, were diving in completely and were willing to set aside 4 hours to kind of like plot our way clumsily through figuring out what Dungeons and Dragons is. Because especially from the outside, it looks very intimidating. Like,
yo, you got to buy a whole textbook.
Yeah, there's a literal textbook. And then when you say, okay, so this is the textbook to run the game, they're like, no, that's the textbook to play the game. There are five more textbooks to run the game, you uncultured swine. But then you read all those textbooks and you get to this point where it's like, oh, I don't actually need any textbooks. And that's where you reach D&D enlightenment in this weird way.
Yeah. One thing that I ended up drumming up that I had an email that I would send to every time new players wanted to come in, and I just had condensed the important parts of the player's handbook into like 5 pages and being like, okay, if you want to be a spellcaster, I'll write down a list of spells for you, you know, and we'll go over that individually. The broad strokes are it's more challenging to play when you can do a couple neat tricks, you know?
So describing how much you're using the real world as a sort of, I want to say template, maybe that's not exactly the right word, but we'll go with that for now.
I like campaign setting.
Yeah, okay. As much as you're using the real world as a basis for your setting, you know, how do you prep your players for the setting? Like, how do you describe it to them, and how do you, you know, guide them through, you know, character creation? Because I always think that's one of the sort of early, you know, tutorial things that you have to demystify a little bit, because character sheets are very intimidating too.
Oh, for sure. One thing that I like to do is have them start with imagining what guy they want to be in a fantasy story. Mm-hmm. Start with the character and then build your sheet from that. So, you know, and I always have very lax rules for stats rolling. I go with 4d6, drop your lowest, and then assign them wherever you want. It's pretty generous and can get you to your you know, minimum stats for pretty much any class. Minimum stats in second edition are a lot more strict than, as I understand, they are in later editions. I don't know.
Although every now and then the probability gods will screw you over. There was a mini campaign that I participated in where I managed to do 4d6 and not get a single stat over an 11.
Well, I also one thing that I always tell all my new players is also, you know, high stats make the game easy, low stats make the game fun. So you gotta keep that in mind. Like, you don't want to walk around like you're Superman blowing laser beams out of your eyes at everybody. You want to have some challenges. You want, and it also, I do a very role play based game style. I do, you know, because when I was a kid, I was a drama kid, so that's the energy that I bring to D&D.
Same.
You know, I'm not from the war game side of it, you know. So when I see guys, there was a huge fad for miniatures and like miniature diorama building for a while. And I was like, no. I'm not doing any of that. They're just trying to get more money out of me. I spent all the money I'm going to spend back in the 90s. I'm done. And that's also the fatal business flaw with Dungeons & Dragons. But they seem to be working their way around it.
Wizards of the Coast is figuring things out. And
yeah, I'm not too worried about. They've seemed to have gotten the magic train rolling again. I'm not worried about Wizards of the Coast at all.
Yeah, I mean, we can go on about Magic the Gathering, but I mean, I've always gotten by with Theater of the Mind, and at most technical, I get made fun of for this all the time, is I used to keep like one of those like mini whiteboards so I could just pull it up and like just quickly diagram out a map.
Yeah.
And not even do like official hex squaring or anything like that. I would just do a quick diagram and just say, this is where the party is. This is where this one person is. Here's a precipice. Here's a thing.
Yeah.
Just so you have when like a sense of like where everything is in relation to you.
Yeah. Sometimes it can get complicated. Sometimes players want to do something specific. And so they need to, you know if that's going to be possible. It's like, yeah, all right. Yeah. That, you know, I'll always have some scrap paper around for notes. Hopefully you'll have a player that has some graph paper that's doing a math for them. But also, like, I keep a lot of that stuff very casual, in part because it saves me a lot of prep time, and in part it keeps my players from getting stressed out. You know, I want to keep things light and goofing around. And so very rarely do I encounter a player who wants a more serious game.
I'm always more happy having prepped out and taken the time to prep out NPC names, sort of like preload voices to do for them. So I'm not just doing the same quasi-English accent for everybody.
Yep, for sure.
You know, if I can like, I'll do it where I straight up list out celebrities to try to impersonate for each character, even if I know I can't do it.
Yeah, because you're not impersonating them. This is an original character.
Yeah. Even if they are named Christopher Walken in universe.
Yeah. It's
the less he sounds like Christopher Walken, the better.
It's spelled completely differently.
Yeah.
And yeah, I realized after a while that I was naming every, because, you know, new players, they love to be like, oh, I go talk to that guy. Oh, who's that guy? What's your name? They want to know everybody's name. So half the time that's Alan. They're just all Alan. It's fine. This is another guy.
Yeah, I'll share my secret for that, which is I always bring up IMD pages of whatever show I happen to be thinking about, and I'll just pull characters from the show from the IMD
Very
page.
Smart.
Yeah, so there's,
you go to the cast and crew, you've got a million different funny-sounding names.
Yeah, and players always love it when they run into three NPCs named, you know, Troy, then Abed, and then Jeff. They realize Perfect. What's going on.
Yeah.
Oh, so confession, for whatever listeners we have, this show was originally centered around a premise of, let's talk about a piece of art that influences or inspires aspects, pieces, or structures of our campaign. So, Chris, if you want to cue up the piece of art that we're going to jump out of to discuss your, some of your campaigns.
So, one thing that my Dungeon Master Hal recommended to me when we were playing his game, that he, because he worked at Midtown Comics in New York City for ages and ages, and is knows more about comics than anybody I know. And he recommended to me Arak, the Son of Thunder, which was a DC comic that was produced in the early 80s that was about a Native American that gets rescued at sea by a group of Vikings and brought back to Norway. And basically, over the course of the 4 years that the comic was running, slowly makes his way across Europe and Asia and sails back across the Pacific to North America. But he has all these sort of swords and sorcery adventures going on, but it's all based in this one specific time period. Like, he meets Charlemagne. So, you know, it's all supposed to be happening around the age of Charlemagne. And I thought it was just such a fun way to make a setting feel specific and amp up that verisimilitude, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But obviously, like, it's a comic book. It doesn't have to be super well researched. It just has to be evocative, you know? And he ends up befriending, like, a Joan of Arc-style woman. And he goes to Rome, and then there's an anti-pope living under the Vatican, and he has to fight in the anti-pope's arena, you know? Just taking one idea from each place you go was something that I really liked. And it made coming up with stories and big bads so easy. You know what I mean? Like, you're in the Middle East. Oh, you're going to meet a Lamia. You know, oh, you're in Egypt. Oh, there's a Sphinx. You're sailing around the Greek islands. You can Google any Greek island. They've all got a temple. And every temple is dedicated to a different god. And boom, there you've got the idea for your dungeon. You know, it's just such an inspiring way to draw from. And it's a great excuse to sort of learn about the world, too. And if you have players mm-hmm. who are into history and that sort of era, it does help make it a little bit more interesting for them. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And Arrakh does a really good job of capturing that vibe while still keeping it fantastical.
Yeah, there was a part of me that was tempted because I am enjoying the conversation, but I was enjoying just the natural part of the conversation. I was like, do we really have to bring up Arrakh? And I was like, no, we owe it to Arrakh to bring him up because, you know, what you described with the world building and using our real world, our real history as a template is right there. You know, doing my research on this, I wasn't familiar with the comic before you brought it up to me. But I mean, like, you know, I'm a huge comic books fan. Midtown Comics is still in Manhattan. It's a fantastic comic shop, probably one of the best that I've ever been to in my life. And everyone that works there is so knowledgeable. So I've probably run into Hal without even knowing it.
I'm sure you did.
But, you know, obviously there's a lot of, you know, similar to what you described about the mythos of a given region or, you know, area being real. You know, that's kind of what happens in this. This is written by the same person who did Marvel's most popular run of Conan the Barbarian. And after Rob Thomas left Marvel, moved over to DC Comics, and then whereas Conan, according to one critic that I read online named Deuce Richardson of DMRbooks.com, he said, whereas Conan is more Lovecraftian, you know, with Arrakh, he was able to take a more real mythos bent where he's doing this very proto God of War Kratos thing where, you know, you're going from Judeo-Christian pantheons, Native American pantheons. And one thing I really want to give Rob Thomas credit for that I read about is that the Native American tribe that Arrakh comes from is based on the actual Native American tribe and directly named after them, the Quantaka tribe. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing that, but they are the Native American tribe that resided in the northeast coast of North America. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you mentioned, he's meeting Greek pantheons. He's meeting all of these different things. And it is a very rich world that at the same time, you know, pulling from actual history, even without being, you know, while being accurate in some ways, but also taking creative liberties with others, just creates such a rich world. And this comic had a 50-issue run, which, you know, for a small character that had one appearance in an issue, like I think 3 years before, Rob Thomas really squeezed a lot of juice out of that orange, I suppose.
Yeah. And they're quality stuff. You got some art by Gene Colan in some of the early issues that looks really great. Mm-hmm. And it also shows how people from different cultures could navigate, because this did happen. There were like in the movie, The 13th Warrior, you ever see The 13th Warrior? You know, you've got the Middle Eastern guy going up and living with the Vikings. But that's based on stuff that really happened. People really did travel the world in this era, even if it's not something that we know too much about. And to take that as a point of inspiration, I think, is also to let you feel free to not just be like, oh, we're in England and you're all King Arthur's knights. That's what it has to be. Oh, you know, you're in Persia and you're all I don't know, Mamluks or something. You know, you can still have a party of varied international and exciting types of people that you'd be having to meet. And obviously you can still incorporate fantasy in it, you know, because there are huge swaths of history that are unknown to us. You know, all of Europe was basically a forest that could easily have had cities of elves that no one encountered. If you go back to like the 800s, stuff like that, it's there's lots of places to color in the corners with your fantasy.
Mm-hmm. So with regards to Arrakh, and we're going to jump off of this into some of your campaign design and, you know, different elements of campaign design and planning. Is there something that you sort of put in as an Easter egg for yourself that directly references Arrakh in your campaigns? Like, I'm trying to think of, like, I liken it to Kurt Vonnegut and Kilgore Trout. You know how Kilgore Trout is the author that, like, appears in every Vonnegut novel. Like, do you have your Kilgore Trout that comes from Arrakh, maybe?
No. I think my Kilgore Trout comes from my time as a player, and specifically the voice that I used for my character, Carl Shiny Hands, who was probably he was a gnome fighter thief that was a layman but a devout follower of Garl Glittergold, probably my favorite demi-human god. And, you know, he was just a real goofball. He's like, oh, hey, how's it going, friend? You know, I just get to do this, like, old prospector voice. And mm-hmm. so I always love just busting out an old prospector voice when I'm stymied, when they're asking what the eighth merchant's name is and if he has a family, you know?
God, what was the... What was that series of, like, Western shorts that had Tom Waits in it that was on Netflix a while ago? I'm blanking on
it. Oh, yeah. Was that the one that, like, the Coen brothers did?
Yeah,
The one with James Franco being, like, first time?
Yep.
I never watched it. I don't remember.
There are some great shorts in there. Stephen Root, I think, has an amazing appearance in it, which was very underrated because everybody focused on James Franco and Tom Waits, and one of those is somebody we should not have to focus on, so.
Oh.
Yeah,
you decide, listeners.
I'm throwing heat at either James Franco or Tom Waits. Try to guess which one. Let us know in the comments on this episode, please. So, you know, looking over Arrak and, you know, some of the information, I mean, this is probably the most obvious, you know, English lit 101 observation, but a lot of what I saw in terms of the overall saga arc is, you know, great hero's journey, just mm-hmm. 101 stuff. You know, he has his, you know, companion Varda. He meets the old wizard Malagigi, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. But you have the mentor. It's very, you know, you're seeing the Obi-Wan, the Han Solo, mm-hmm. the Princess Leia template. You have your Darth Vader enemy that is a sorcerer in the castle that they are fighting in this evil cult. Mm-hmm. You know, tell me about... What kinds of structures are you using in terms of, you know, you mentioned, like, it's a little bit difficult to sometimes get new players to recognize a plot hook as a plot hook.
One thing is, you know, when I'm starting up a new campaign, mm-hmm. I'll try to get a feel for how long the players want to go. If they want to go for, like, I'll say, let's start with one, and we'll figure out from there. And mm-hmm. with the one, I'll start very local, you know, the classic, you guys... I don't like to start players at first level mm-hmm. because in second edition, it's very easy to die at first level and there's not very much you can do. You actually have to be mm-hmm. like a very cagey player to survive at first level. So I like to start them somewhere around 3 to 5. And I'll say you're already an adventuring party. That mm-hmm. way we can save time. And, you know, just like you always want to say, you don't split the party. Why start with the party split up? You can decide mm-hmm. how it starts. Let's make the CV. Let's get into the game. You're all already an adventuring party. You're all in a tavern. Something happens. There's mm-hmm. something immediate that cannot be ignored. You know, there's a fire. An enemy army is attacking. You mm-hmm. know, this is not, you're looking at the want ads and there's only one ad. Because they're going to go, that sounds bad. You know, and especially new players are... Even more than regular players, new players are always cowards. Mm-hmm. They're always going to try to avoid conflict. They are always... I'm going to say this, and this is sexist, but it's also mm-hmm. 100% true in my experience.
Mm-hmm.
Women will try and flirt with a guard. I've never had a man player try to flirt with me as a guard, but I have had women players try to flirt their way past me consistently.
Mm-hmm.
And... But that does also remind me of a very important rule that I have for new players that I'm going to take as a quick aside.
Go for it.
No sex in D&D.
Interesting.
No one in D&D is going to have sex. In part because, I mean, obviously this is sort of a holdover from the dark days of Dungeons & Dragons when mm-hmm. it was all very lonely nerds that did not understand anything. And mm-hmm. so it's just like, we don't need it. It can make the evening weird much more easily than it can make the evening better, especially if, like, we don't know each other like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm taking this off the table.
So I do want to run some things from my campaigns by you.
Mm-hmm.
I've always historically found, at least maybe this is just the type of people that I've managed to run into in a D&D campaign, I have I have dealt with players whose characters feel so asexual that I always have it as a trump card in my back pocket that if I feel like they're getting a little bit too comfortable with throwing the person with high persuasion at every problem that they run into, I can just throw an overly flirtatious NPC at that person within reason and then just immediately like get them to go, nope, 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 we're out, we're not doing this. So my players actually enforce the no sex rule in D&D, which is very funny, but the offshoot I wanted to ask you about that, because, and tell me if this is a philosophy you agree as well, is that, you know, a responsibility of a DM with regards to, you know, good story play, I suppose, if we can coin that term, is coming up with reasonable consequences to frustrate a decision that the players make.
Yeah.
And, you know, the emphasis there is on the reasonable part. So I wonder if that philosophy doesn't then invoke the sort of like puritanical horror movie mentality where if the kids have sex in the cabin, those two have to die type of thing.
But well, it's not like it's something where they ever like be like, I try to have sex with him. And I'm like, no, no, don't have sex with him. You know, it's just sort of a gentleman's agreement. Like, guys, don't try to have sex with each other. It can make the game weird. If somebody's, it can just make it weird. And everybody's like, yeah, okay, that makes sense. If somebody like really started pushing back on me on that rule, I'd be like, I'm sorry. And obviously it's a rule that you can sort of like lay by the wayside as people become comfortable with each other. You get to know each other better. You have a better sense of humor with each other. Like I played a game with a group of musicians from New York's anti-folk music scene. And they, that's a scene that's very into both comedy and sexist comedy, just as like an aesthetic trope. And so like in that game, we ended up going to like some sort of carnival theme park planet. Because I brought in some Spelljammer elements, and there was the adult side of the planet with Mount Prostitute, the mountain made of prostitutes. You know, like you, obviously, when you're comfortable with each other and you know that you're goofing around, it's fine. But it's also very different to be like, the wizened old man shows you his dick. Like, nobody wants to have that be your evening.
Man, oh, so teaser for a future episode. Again, I was dealing with a player who's been going on a pretty impressive run for the series in terms of like how long he's lasting. So, you know, in case anybody listening to the early episodes thinks that there's a 2-episode limit, there is no limit, actually. It's legitimately how far can a player run. But I did have an NPC. Yeah. It's a roguelike. It's, you know, it's if you pick up the sticks on your turn at the, you know, Dark Souls 2 run and you manage to get through 3 bosses, hey, you get through 3 bosses. You know?
Yeah, good luck.
And then sometimes you're going to run into that one boss that you have to take 20 tries at. Hey, we've all been there. But, but you know, I threw a little bit of that, like, where he was getting a little bit too chummy. He was getting through, you know, some of the NPC diplomatic challenges a little bit too easy. So I decided to throw him off his game with just like, you know, oh, he shakes your hand. And then his 2 fingers just lightly rub the inside of your wrist as he makes deep eye contact with you, just to throw him off balance a little bit. And it worked perfectly because that just instantly, he was very clearly plotting a certain infiltration route. And then that just immediately made him say, nope, I'm not going to use this guy as my in. I'm going to split off. And caused its own complications. But, you know, with regards to like, the 2 kids sneaking off to the cabin thing, at that point, I start reaching for my monster manual and thinking, okay, what's hiding in the closet as a consequence of this? There may not have been something in the closet otherwise, but, you know, again, reasonable complications of, like, what's going on.
Related to that, I remember once as a player for a long time, I played a bard named Arbin, who naturally had a 17 charisma, but had accumulated, because this game had gone on for so long, and we had so much power creep in the game, that by the time we stopped playing, I think he was a 13th level bard, 15th level magic user, and he could at will raise his charisma to 24 and to be like not just a god but like a god of charmingness. And so like and he ended up marrying a demigod of death that granted him immortality effectively. So he kind of retired. But that's also, But there was at one point a tournament of like everybody was going to put in a magic item, and the winners at the end would get the magic items, and they would also get, you know, a big prize, something like that. Mm-hmm. And so Arben's plan was to just charm every person that he met into quitting. And I made it to like the third round before I encountered someone that was like blind and deaf, and they just murdered me. And like, sometimes, you know, like all the time with new cowardly players, they'll try and like talk their way out of having to fight someone, as opposed to being like, no, this is the part of the game we're going to do combat. I know there's a lot of rules. I know you guys don't want to do it, but it's part of D&D. So this is what's going to happen. You guys are going to have to fight. So eventually you just have to put them up against a non-sentient monster. Like, now's when you got to fight your gibbering monster, a gibbering mouther, you know? Now's when you get attacked by a pack of wolves.
One of the best bits of NPC advice I ever got for dealing with, you know, high charisma face players, you know, as much as you have to deal with them. Maybe that's a harsh term, but
yeah.
Somebody told me, you know, dumb people are harder to convince of things than smart people, because, you know, dumb people entrench themselves really easily. And, you know, I mean, it's not hard to see when you look at America.
It's true.
So, you know, this, I've always justified like, oh, the dumber the character, the easier it is for me to impose disadvantage or just say, no, sorry, you're not going to win this argument with them. They are just too dumb to listen to you, and you're being way too eloquent. Like, they don't want to listen to you because you sound way too smart and for your own good. And, you know, there's always, so I do want to get into challenges, you know, both in terms of scenarios, because, you know, we have the broader campaign. Like, we talk about, like, you know, broader villains, monsters, and stuff like that. So let's bring it down to, like, party walks into a town. You know, tell me about what you're thinking about in terms of, you know, let's say there's a goal, like a MacGuffin that they need to retrieve. Or, you know, how do you tend to like to set up your sandboxes for the players in terms of what they can achieve, what they should achieve, and the different routes to get there, different sorts of, you know, are you thinking in terms of routes? Are you thinking in terms of just here's a setting and just being holistic about it?
Normally, what I'll do is I will have a dungeon in mind, because I know that new players, if they're not going to a dungeon, they're not playing Dungeons and Dragons. And normally it'll be something relatively small. It'll be a wizard's house. It'll be catacombs underneath an old temple. It'll be a cave full of gnolls. And, you know, something that I can build, like, a small ecosystem around. Because for me, when it comes to designing a dungeon, one thing that Hal taught me that I thought was always very effective was that form should follow function. That, you know, every room in a dungeon should have a purpose. You need another room there, make sure it's the kitchen. You're not just walking to another 10 by 20 stone room, you know. They're not playing Legend of Zelda. And so I will normally try to sort of let my players sort of goof around for a little while. Just let them play in a town. Because they're only going to think of so many places to go. There's going to be the tavern. There's going to be, where do adventurers go in town? Oh, you go to the Adventurer's Guild. And then they go to the Adventurer's Guild. And they go, oh, I want to go to the store. Anytime they think they're going to have to go out of town, they want to go and buy a horse. Like it matters. Like they're really going to have to walk. I don't understand why they always do this. And then when they get to the horse dealer, they never want to pay the list price for the horse. So they, I got to spend 10 minutes haggling with them as a stingy horse dealer, which is fun, but it's always just like, why are you guys doing this? This is, but that's new players for you. And that's what's always so fun is they hit these consistent beats. But eventually they'll talk to someone who they kind of like. I'll find someone that they're talking to that I can goof around with, and they'll be interested in that person. And then that person will be like, oh, actually, my uncle owns a farm on the outside of town and he's been having trouble. Oh, you know, that's the person that gives them the hook. I wait for them to get invested with someone and then I try and land them that way. And so that person obviously has to be sort of up to chance. but I have to lead them on to someone who then will be sort of their main companion through it. That'll be sort of my proxy shepherding them along to some extent. Sometimes I'll just insert myself in the party if it's only like two people. I'm like, you really need a party of three, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But then they'll meet someone who almost always, at the end of the story, whoever sends them on the adventure always betrays them. I always have them get betrayed for two reasons. One is because it sets up a hook if they want to keep playing again.
Mm-hmm.
And two, it teaches them to be both sort of cagey, but also realize that I am setting them up to fail. They had to take this adventure hook. That's what we were doing tonight. And the adventure was going to be that you fail, because it's always funny to me when players fail, and that's the stories that I like to tell.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite things to do. I also tell new players that they can't be evil, because then they're going to be dicking each other over all night. It's going to end up in hurt feelings. You know, you're going to have to stab your best friend in the back. It sucks. You got to be at least neutral. But whenever they're like, oh no, I'm lawful good. And then they get attacked by a group of brigands in the middle of the night, or a group of orcs in the middle of the night, and they like start slaughtering them. Mm-hmm. I always start throwing out, oh, my wife! Oh my God! Oh my God, I just had a son! I always make good players be like, this, you are killing people. You are supposed to be good. That's how I like try and keep them on rolls with that. And that's like, I love setting players up for moral conundrums for which there is no good answer, because it's always funny to watch them squirm.
Yeah, it is funny how easy it is to catch players off guard when they get course corrected. And I usually do it with an NPC calling them out, like after they've gone too far down the road, where it's like, wait, you all think you're the good guys? Like, I'm sorry, we've left a trail of bodies in your wake. You've stolen multiple world-ending magical items. You are not the good guys here.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always fun to make them take that sort of step back and realize if you play Dungeons & Dragons the same way that you play World of Warcraft, you're leaving a trail of bodies behind you.
So I want to follow the betrayer sort of like introduction, because that is such a great hook. I've done the one session sort of like D&D demo thing, and I always use the same scenario for mine, but I don't have such an artful hook to end mine and potentially get them to come back for more. Mine is usually like ending with a few dick jokes in like a monastery, and then like, okay, if you all want to come back for poop jokes next week, like,
yeah.
But the betrayer is such a good thing. So like, tell me about what you do with the betrayer if a player comes back, if a group of players comes back to follow that plot line. Like, where,
then
how much are you being informed by their decisions of how they're viewing the betrayer versus what are you setting the betrayer up as?
I will normally set the betrayer up as part of some sort of larger evil organization with a larger evil goal. Some sort of like good old Saturday morning cartoon type of villainy. You know, you've got your sort of international conspiracy of like eight different bad guys. One of them's like Count Dracula. One of them's a mummy stuck in somewhere. And one of them's a wizard that lives in an ice castle, you know. And so, and this guy, he can be part of that council. He can be subservient to one guy in the council, you know. But it, that way, sort of everywhere they go, no matter which direction they want to head, in sort of a broad sense, I can have something waiting for them. It's a big world that's full of dangers, but it's also something where they can act locally. They can dismantle with individual quests. You know, it's sort of like your classic A plot, B plot of the week. Whenever they, I'm setting up the next session or the next, you know, run. Okay. So it'll be, you know, the next town. They'll, or, you know, they'll finish up their quest and they'll be like, oh, he headed, we saw him heading north. He was fleeing to the next town, blah, blah, blah. So they ride off to the next town. But, and the next town, they get another adventure hook to deal with something that's in that town. And, but they also, depending on, I'll normally, you know, they'll go to their tavern, they'll get the lay of the land, and you can throw out a couple of different adventure hooks for the next, like, session. And I sort of break it down session by session, town by town, because, you know, in that sort of real world setting that I like to use, there's vast swaths of uninhabited land that is just sort of, you know, filler, and it helps break it up into ideas. And when somebody finishes up the arc, you can say, you know, after you give everybody their XP, so what do you guys think you want to do next? You think you're going to go to, are you going to go to Nice, or are you going to head on up to Paris? You know, are you going to, and then you can figure out which one you have to plan next. And everything else, you can just plant as something to be pursued later and fill in as much detail as you want. And if one of them is exciting to you, you can drop more hooks and more clues that they should be heading that way.
And that, the invocation of eight members of an organization reminds me of another pan-geographic legendary warrior that I'll invoke in this conversation. Are you familiar with the Mega Man series?
Yes. Yes, you could easily have a very... You could definitely structure your story around Mega Man. You know, or I like to think of it as sort of anytime there was a G.I. Joe miniseries, you need to go get the three parts of the machine. One's in the desert, one's in the jungle, one's in the Arctic.
I was a very dumb 10-year-old, and the first Mega Man game I ever played was Mega Man X. And I remember it being revolutionary to me. I played that game for entirely too long before
that
I
was a great game.
Out that it was. It was one of the best games ever made. But I played that game entirely too long before I finally figured out that, oh, some of these weapons, the monster, the other bosses are weak to different weapons. Like, I think it was like, maybe I think I'd beaten the game without knowing a single, like, Maverick's weakness. Like, I just powered through it with the regular lemon shooter.
Yeah.
Which is honestly feels like a challenge mode that most people should try at some point in their lives. But,
no, it's doable. It's a strategy.
But yeah. But yeah, the first time I ever noticed that, like, oh, the mammoth guy, like, has a special animation whenever I hit him with this weapon. Like, it was wild to me.
Yeah, that will blow your mind.
Yeah.
And that's always funny to sort of, you know, some dungeon masters will do this, but after we've finished up a dungeon, I'll do a little like, oh, here's what you missed. You know what I mean? Especially if it's one of the type of dungeon where, you know, the whole thing collapsed behind them, you know, so they can't go back and get whatever it was. But it does help your new players think of ways to think about things, or at least think of the way that I'm thinking about things so they're in sync with me as a dungeon master.
So with regards to, so I did invoke Mega Man for a reason. You know, I wanted
Please
to
go
ask,
on.
With regards to these sort of like, you know, different players on the board and different like locations that they can choose to go to, you know, as you're planning out the next one, how much do you ever put in like a hidden weakness or like a sort of a get out of jail free card or something like that based on something they might have already accomplished so that there's this sense of continuity and building on things? Like, do you ever do that sort of thing, or do you do kind of the alternate version of that, which is like the Buffy the Vampire Slayer thing, where it's a monster of the week until the end of the season where we meet the like thing that ties it all together in and of itself?
I would say that I'm a lot more freewheeling than that. I think it's good to give your players the illusion that there's a larger plan. And I think a real world setting helps set that up because it feels so filled in already. But I think, I'm rarely planning more than two sessions out just because that's the amount of emotional labor I want to bring into it. Like, I remember my dungeon master, Al, he would bring us like 20 pages of documents and be like, this is what you found in the dungeon. And eventually when I rolled up Carl Shiny Hands and I switched characters, he was illiterate. So I didn't have to do any of that. The other guys could deal with that. And players, if you really want to stymie a dungeon master, make your character illiterate. You'll really cut through the game. It saves you a lot of time.
On the flip side, if you ever want to do your DM a favor, make your character a warlock and give him Eyes of the Runekeeper.
No, that was one thing. In second edition, there's Bardic Knowledge, which basically gives you 5% chance per level for a bard to identify a magic item. And we expanded that idea to just general knowledge. So by a 14th level bard, I had a 70% chance of knowing just about anything, which really saved us a lot of trouble in terms of like having someone do background story for us. Just like, okay, no, you just know that. Okay, this guy just knows that. You don't need to go find the vizier. You don't need to go talk to the oldest man in town to find out, oh, that guy's actually a vampire. Now you know he's a vampire. You've heard of that guy, he's a vampire. Mm-hmm. I just saved us all 10 minutes.
And I mean, honestly, that's a DM's dream. Like, I think all of us kind of worry. I don't know if you ever have this, but like, when you ask for a perception roll and you think about, oh my God, why did I create even a 5% chance that the players mm-hmm. will not notice this thing that I want them to notice, that I practically need them to notice. So, you know, it's interesting having the mechanics work for you like that.
My other dirty secret is with newbie players, they never learn the rules. So I just tell them, what did you roll? Roll a D20. What did you get? I got a 12. You did it. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. You just let it slide. Half the time, I won't even keep track of hit points. I'll be like, this is getting boring. I should wrap this up. Oh, you got him. Oh, that one's down too. Oh, there's one left, you know, and it just, you don't want to make the experience subservient to the rules, but also you don't want it to feel arbitrary for your players. So I try not to make it too egregious, but you know, if somebody's down to 3 hit points instead of 1 and, you know, you're dealing with a bunch of players who all have, you know, non-magical weapons and really bad THACOs, then let's just, come on. This isn't doing anybody any favors. Don't get bogged down in that shit. That's also why I almost never kill players.
Oh, yeah. I think I don't know a single DM that I've ever talked to who, and this is a revelation for listeners, no DM actually honestly tracks boss encounter HP. I don't know a single one who is lawful good as a DM when it comes to that.
Hal has me convinced, but I'll confess I never... Hal said that it was always very important to him to be impartial, or at least give the air of impartiality. And I think the air of impartiality is much more valuable than the impartiality.
Yeah. I think the air of impartiality is a matter of trust, and I think it's a matter of also, because what is the goal of a DM? And I mean, I think that, you know, if a DM is too railroady and, you know, way too rules lawyery about themselves, and like we said about that infallibility, then, you know, loving community aside, and Abed as a DM, there is this sort of like, well, what's the goal of this? It's to have a good time. And I think that's where we all come down, where we've all had that moment, especially as early DMs, at some point where you see the room starting to like slacken a little bit because the boss encounter is going on a little bit too long. And I said this on one of the co-op episodes with Trevor Hegstrom, but you know, when you really boil down D&D combat, it's just roll a dice, does this hit, roll your damage, and then it's just that back and forth. And you know, we're always looking to keep it exciting. It's exciting at first when players are excited to get those first hits in and stuff like that, and if it gets dangerous, but you know, especially 3 boss encounters in, you know, you're looking for ways to spice it up. So that's segue into another question. What are your techniques for spicing up battle? You know, aside from pacing, like, what do you throw at players to keep battles different? And, you know, are there monster switch-ups and misleads or misdirects? Are there environmental things? What do you like to do?
I like to keep it light. I like to keep it sort of unintimidating. You know, and especially when you get into large groups, you really want to make sure that you're burning through it as quick as you can. And I like to introduce one new mechanic per fight. You know, last time you were fighting a couple of zombies, this time there's a ghoul in there. He's got a paralyzing touch. Watch out, he might paralyze you. Let's everybody learn about saving throws, you know, or just little things like that. And also to make sure that you can give the monster some personality. That it's not just, you know, some 8-bit graphics that are popping up on your screen, that it is a monster that makes sense where it is, it, you know, and has something memorable about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it can speak and it's got a funny voice and a funny little accent as it's threatening to kill you. And once again, if they're sentient, players are almost always going to try and talk their way out of it ahead of time. So mm-hmm. you can, and trying to find different ways to escalate it. You know, and also it's funny how new players can be both very, greedy
mm-hmm.
and very, you know, flinty with their money, but they can also, just try to bribe their way out of everything. But as cowardly as they are, if they offer to bribe, say, the five goblins that are attacking them in the middle of the night to go away, then the goblins mm-hmm. say, well, then we're just going to take all your money. And now mm-hmm. they're in that situation where I've got them in another no good out situation. Mm-hmm. Either they have to fight or they have to give up all their cash. And that'll normally motivate them. But yeah, just making sure that it's not wave after wave of the same vibe, I think is important. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a favorite monster to play that you kind of keep as like your MVP star? Or is there a certain type of monster that you really enjoy running?
I've got a couple of faves. I love a good Bullywug. I think they're so funny with that big goofy frog mouth. And you know, just this sort of society that a group of frog people would make up. And, you know, whenever they start killing them indiscriminately, they get to cry out, "Oh, my tadpoles!" <You know? laughs> Like, it's just so goofy to have frogmen running around. And I love if they're just in the forest and they're like, okay, you got to walk to the next town. It's 3 days through the forest. And one day they roll a random encounter. Mm-hmm. But I always make low hostile random encounter, high friendly random encounter. And my classic friendly random encounter is just a giant talking catfish that lives in the lake. I'm the old catfish that lives in the lake. And I don't know anything about anything except what's in this lake. And what's in this lake is me. And I'm great. And they'll talk to that guy for like 20 minutes. And they'll be like, oh, I love good old big catfish.
So you reminded me, I've been trying not to talk too much about my own campaigns for the nature of this please. Conversation, but I have to share one of these, which is a few years ago, I ran a campaign for a few of our mutual friends on what was formerly the Bird app and who are now on Blue Sky with us. And I had wanted to run a Bullywog encounter, but the day of the session, I don't know what computer magic, I didn't bookmark the Bullywug stat block correctly, so I just didn't have a monster stat block, and I could not remember any of the numbers. And I was thinking to myself, I was panicking and thinking to myself, like, I could make up a stat block, as one does, and just kind of, like, guesstimate, like, let's just set down 17 armor class, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Like, you can, at a certain point in DMing, you know how to make a reasonable boss encounter that's...
Yeah, know, like, every... random little guy that you're going to meet is going to be somewhere from 3 to 7 hit points.
Yeah.
1d6 damage.
This is the kind of damage that they should be doing. These are the kind of moves they can have to really, you know, mess with the party and give them like 3 special moves. But I decided to make this guy more of an NPC where they could talk it out. Like I wanted to, so I decided to zag on it a little bit where it looked like it was going to be a boss encounter. And then it was like, oh, cause I'd been my tone was leading into the boss encounter type of like monologue.
Mm-hmm.
And then it ended up being just an NPC with a silly voice that was a frog that talked like this. And great. his name was Chet Hanks. and Chet ended up journeying with the party. And I think the most famous thing that happened to him is that Chet wore a disguise to pose as a high elf on the Elfin Nobility Council.
Okay.
Rolled a nat 20. And so it became canon in the world that Chet was like Chicken Boo. Where if he disguised himself as this one elf, and I just remembered the elf's name was Boutros Ghali.
Okay.
Because of course.
Yeah, no, that's the type of a name that elves have.
Yeah. You know, Chet could perfectly disguise himself as Boutros Ghali, and only one member of the party rolled a nat 20 on perception to be able to see through it. So it was a total Chicken Boo thing where... this one character be like, that's not Boutros. What are you talking about? And he was like, shut up. Yeah. You're gonna
You think I don't know You're making us look crazy in front of Boutros Boutros.
We're going to lose our inn with the Elf Nobility Council. All right. So I think I figured out how to end these episodes. And of course, the best way to end anything is with an ending. So I'm going to ask you, what is your favorite ending for a session or an overall campaign that you've ever run?
Oh, geez.
I know it's a I pulled that one out of nowhere. Yeah. I should have prepped you for that one. I'm sorry. I'm a bad host.
Well, no, it's all right. I will. The best ending that I can remember is one that I had as a player for my character, Carl Shiny Hands, the first time he died. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, we were all about to be captured somewhere in the Black Forest, I believe by an opposing party that was possibly an evil circus from China. The nefarious circus of Dr. Lao, I think they were. And
nefarious is such a great word. Fantastic.
Yeah. They were great. But Carl, we had some sort of like chest that was trapped to explode. Mm-hmm. And so Carl, with his -9 hit points, grabbed the chest, ran towards the circus of Dr. Lao and yelled out, "Fuck everything forever," before popping open the box and blowing up everybody. And there's something good about a good death for a character. And having your character die on your own terms. Mm-hmm. You know, you hate to fall victim to a bad role somewhere. But it's good to remember that your characters can die and you can be okay. And it's fun to roll up new characters, you know?
Oh, yeah.
It's a Chinese crisis. That's what we like to call those.
The world and life goes on.
Yeah. Yeah. It's Dungeons and Dragons, man. It's all part of the story.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. Listeners, check out my podcast. Your Favorite Bad Movie Podcast. It's the only podcast that's brave enough to ask the question, if this movie's so bad, why do you like it so much? Different guest every week talking about their favorite bad movie with my wife and my old buddy Greg.
It's a fun podcast, and it also has the kind of catalog at this point where, at this point, anytime I'm thinking of a bad movie, I will search your show's library to see if you have an episode on it. And it's getting to the point where, like, I think the last couple times I thought of them, I thought of Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift the other day, actually.
yeah, oh, I love that movie. That's the best
Fantastic.
One.
Fantastic. And it's a great, and I will recommend that as a great starter episode for anybody that's new to the show. But really and truly, search through the whole catalog. It's great to listen to fully in order or just pick out your favorite shows. But Chris, it was great having you. Thank you so much for being here. And I'm looking forward to being on the show someday.
Yes, very soon. And thank you so much. Goodbye.